Welcome to This Is AI, the podcast that looks at the world of artificial intelligence and machine learning and figures out what it means for you.
Hi, welcome to the podcast. I'm Gary Pretty.
And I'm Jonathan Seal.
And this week we are going to be focusing on John's trip to South by Southwest. I've also been out at the MVP Summit in Seattle, where Microsoft have been telling me lots of interesting insights of what's coming up in the next few months. But as I'm under NDA, I can't talk about anything. So hopefully John's got enough interesting anecdotes to tell us to fill the podcast.
Yeah, otherwise it's going to be a very, very short episode, isn't it?
Absolutely, yeah. But as always, we're going to start off with our news section. And I think John's going to kick us off with a story about the Mayor of London.
Indeed, yes. So actually this does relate slightly to South by Southwest, not to jump ahead, but so Sadiq Khan, Mayor of London, he has commissioned a fairly comprehensive study on artificial intelligence that's going to really look at how we can make sure that the policies that they put in place are set up to help London, you know, thrive in this emerging world, which I think is a really exciting development. I mean, he's got Cognition X, a really, really solid organisation. That's Charlie Muirhead and Tabitha Goldstaub, who are really looking to try and do some digging into the industry and look at, in particular, kind of four key areas. So there's about how we get adoption and deployment of AI across the city, how we can make sure we're attracting the right talent and getting businesses and entrepreneurs to set up there, and then looking at, you know, how barriers can be removed and how we can support growth. So yeah, just a really exciting development in that area. And then something that followed on from that, just to leap straight into the next news story. So Emmanuel Macron, so President of France, has also sort of is getting in on the game of AI. I think he's notable because whereas most of Europe is very traditionally against invasion of privacy, very hot on those laws. Obviously, the whole GDPR thing has come about really as a result of the European direction on that. He's really looking for Europeans to kind of relax a little bit of that, be a bit more chilled out and, about how they use, about how the data is being used. And I think that's going to be an interesting development because he really sees that innovation in AI is going to be a massive differentiator for nations. And so he's seeing that there's a potential for Europe, especially, to fall significantly behind if they're not opening up data to be used in sensible ways.
Yeah, it's going to be a really interesting tussle, I think, over the next sort of 6-12 months and beyond, just in terms of how people react to this sort of thing. I think generally with the environment as it currently is, people are very reticent to let their data go anywhere or to be used by anybody. Obviously, we've got the GDPR regulations coming in, which will allow you to effectively have yourself deleted from people's systems. But without this data, you know, data is the fuel for AI, and without that, you know, it's questionable about how much benefit that's going to have. So if you ask to delete yourself from lots of systems, you're potentially also then removing benefits from AI driven solutions as well. So I think that's going to be a really interesting tussle over the next few years, and I think it'll be really interesting to see how organizations can potentially market the idea of being able to use your data to you. So I saw a really nice example this week, specifically around GDPR, of a cruise line company who sent out an email to all of the people who were subscribed to their list, their mailing list, and it was effectively a personalized video of saying, here's the last cruise you went on, here are all the things you saw, and it took them through this really nice reminiscent journey of their last holiday, and then right at the end it said, but we'd still like to give you, you know, insights and offers for your next holiday, and actually if you'd like that, then click here and you can opt in. Right now we're on the precipice, certainly with GDPR, of a lot of people just being automatically opted out of a lot of these systems and having, you know, not being able to be proactively contacted. And I think there's certainly a risk. I say a risk, I'm going to say a risk that people will not have their data in these systems to take advantage. And I think that could really, really hamper some of the organisations, certainly in the UK and more broadly in Europe, to innovate.
Indeed. So I know you've got a story that you want to talk about to do with translation, and it's a Microsoft one, funnily enough.
Funnily enough, yeah, absolutely. So I think every time we do this podcast, we seem to be talking about the latest news or the latest breakthrough in AI. And one of the things we've touched on a lot is translation. And Microsoft Research have recently announced that they've made a fairly significant breakthrough when it comes to translation of Chinese news through to English. This really is a big deal. You know, traditionally being able to take somebody's speech, maybe a single sentence or a paragraph, and translating that has been fairly accurate now and has been for some time. But trying to translate something that's, you know, much larger, like a news article, has still required quite a bit of human intervention. And what Microsoft have been able to do now, and they've validated this with, I think, around 2,000 articles, and they've brought in outside linguists as well, linguist specialists, to validate the translation. Mm-hmm. They've now got to the point where they've got parity between the AI and human translation, where you can't tell the difference between the two. It's fascinating.
Yeah. In fact, I think when I was reading up on this, they were suggesting that the sort of typical format is that you'll get someone who'll translate and then someone who'll kind of sanity check, yeah, for meaning. And so they've taken this deliberation approach, and then apply that in this context. So there's almost like one AI or one pass through it, where it'll just do the translation, and then another where it'll almost step back and say, does this now all make sense? You know, and now I put it all together, does it feel like it's the most meaningful way I can describe this? And so it then optimizes and improves the translation just to sort of make it flow more naturally and be a bit more meaningful.
Yeah, it's just another great example of how quickly things are moving in this space. And I'm sure by the time we record the next podcast, there'll be another one for me to talk about. So absolutely fascinating. The next thing I wanted to talk about is really related to some of the things we've been talking about on previous podcasts again. And this is open banking. So the open banking initiative has recently effectively been given the rubber stamp. And what the open banking initiative does is provides a framework for third parties, maybe app builders or website builders, or even, you know, chatbot builders, to be able to access, with your permission, and to the degree that you agree to, your data from your banking organization. So you can imagine almost an app developer for a sort of a master banking app, and you being able to give the permission for you to for the app to have access to your Halifax accounts and your HSBC accounts, and have them all within a single place. Now, on the face of it, that sounds great, and simply being able to draw all of those things together in a single place is fantastic. But I think what this really opens the door for is the things that we've been talking about on previous podcasts, which is the ability for somebody to, as a third party, to innovate and use your financial history and your transaction history to be able to gain some insights through AI in terms of your spending habits, maybe your propensity to buy a particular product, maybe targeted advertising. I mean, the options are really endless with this. But I think we're at the cusp now, where the framework is there. The financial authorities are going to jump on board and effectively open the doors, and now we've got to see what AI runs through it.
Yes, and we all kind of knew this was coming. We all knew that the open banking scenario would play out. It was just, I suppose, A, that it's happened fairly quickly, but I suppose more to the point is that how the intelligence is going to be laid over the top of it, because that's the critical bit. Because it's very easy to start saying, oh, now we've got all this data, we can do some amazing stuff with it, but you know, what are the insights that are actually going to add value? What are the services and predictions and detailed context that you can get about somebody's life and their biometrics and their location and all those kind of things that are going to actually prove meaningful in the long term? And I just think we're at the very early stage of that, but yeah, fascinating to see how it plays out.
Yeah,
I've got one quick one on. So Huawei, the technology manufacturer, they have always had a fairly strong play in the consumer tech space, and their sort of smartphones and cameras and so on are pretty well received. But I just saw an interesting AI angle on the latest camera that they've been talking about on their smartphones, which is that it's building in AI to deliver on the image stabilization. Now, AI's been used quite a bit in image processing in various ways, and we've talked about it before on the podcast. But I think this is an interesting one because it's the results seem to be pretty impressive. I mean, obviously, if you stick, you know, liquid around a lens and you're able to sort of avoid that kind of movement, that's great. But obviously, that's more costly. But in this instance, they were able to achieve really quite impressive results by having a machine learning algorithm look at the likely movement that was going to be occurring on a frame by frame basis, and then correct that pixel by pixel and achieve some really interesting results. So I think, yeah, it's going to be interesting to see how what we've normally perceived as being quite physical restrictions, i.e., you know, it's only as good as the lens that you've got, kind of thing, be able to be turned on the head a little bit just by adding this intelligent layer on top.
Yeah, and this just harks back to our last episode of, you know, AI in plain sight, and you know, how AI can be affecting everybody without them even realizing it. I'm sure that, you know, right now this has been a breakthrough for Huawei, but you know, in 12 months time, I think it's probably likely that, you know, all of the other phone manufacturers, providing the results are as good as they say they are, will roll out something very similar, and it will just be normal for everybody.
Okay, so we couldn't possibly finish the news without talking about some news that's been pretty fundamental in the whole world of AI and machine learning, because it's spilled over so spectacularly into everyday news that we're all very familiar with, and that's Cambridge Analytica. And I suppose this is our way of combining the news section and our typical nefarious use of AI in the same segment. So I suppose, first of all, let's have a really quick recap over, you know, what we are talking about here. So Cambridge Analytica, firm that have been heavily involved in looking at personal insight information, and they have been accused of harvesting, I think it's 50 million Facebook user profiles without permission, that then enabled them to, you know, rake in the sort of commercial models of being able to sell that on in particular ways. And one of the most obvious and high profile ways they've used that is to try and influence the US presidential elections in 2016. And I suppose one of the big deals in this whole scenario is that in 2015, so obviously before all that happened, Facebook were very clearly warned that this was going on, and that the Facebook profiles were being mined in this way, in a way that was totally inappropriate, and that most users weren't aware of. So I think it's a fascinating and hugely kind of political issue that's now evolving. What's your take on it, Gary?
Yeah, I guess my take is I wasn't in any way surprised, but I think we're embedded in this world on a day-to-day basis. I think there's a lot of surprise out there from people who just don't necessarily consider the information that they're putting into, you know, platforms like Facebook could possibly be used in this way. I'm not even really surprised about the scale. I actually think this is probably going to open the door to, you know, a whole heap of additional revelations about other platforms. I very much doubt Facebook are the only ones.
And I'm sure Cambridge Analytica weren't the only ones doing
that science. Yeah, exactly. I think this is just probably the tip of the iceberg, where someone's identified, because it's a very high profile connection to things like the US election and potentially Brexit. Obviously, it's got a lot of traction in the news, but I really think we're going to see a whole heap more of these things. But again, this comes back to, you know, things like this are the reason why the EU want to lock down on, you know, the use of data, and that, you know, never-ending tussle between how much data do I give to someone and how much benefit do I get back. But the scale of it is just incredible.
Yeah, and I suppose the interesting implication that we've all got to grapple with now, and it's something we have talked about before, is this is a logical outcome of when you are the product. You know, we are all the products of Facebook and Twitter and so on. We're not paying for the service. We are paying for the service, but we're paying for it with our data rather than with our currency. And they're essentially just turning that into currency themselves by selling that data on in various ways. And what I suppose I'm fascinated by is how Facebook are going to properly respond to this in the medium term, because in the short term they can do all sorts of, you know, either denials or apologies or all these kind of things that they're doing. But longer term, I mean, fundamentally, that is the business model, you know, selling user data, whether it's aggregated or anonymized or whatever, to a point where it can then be used to target individual people with tailored advertising is fundamentally what they do. So I'm not entirely sure how they're going to get away from this.
Yeah, and it's not a new idea, is it? Targeted marketing is not a new idea. It's just the fact that they were able to do it on such a massive scale and that they were able to gain the data of various user profiles for users who hadn't even interacted with the app. They just happened to be friends with people who had, you know, completed various surveys. I think, you know, in the longer term, it will be interesting to see how Facebook will respond to it, because I think, you know, certainly the responses that we've seen in the last week or so have been, well, you know, this isn't our fault. Somebody broke our terms of service, effectively. And how do Facebook police this, you know, going forward? Because, you know, yep, it would appear that Facebook knew this was going on, you know, a number of years ago and should have done something about it. But what happens when, you know, they can update their terms of service? But if someone breaks their terms of service, there will be a limit to which they can respond.
I suppose what it, without wanting to get massively off a topic into a whole, you know, political conversation, it does really speak to the fact that the balance of power between corporations at this, you know, in this new world order and nation states is definitely tipping. And, you know, we are entering a world where the likes of the Facebooks and the Googles and the Apples and the Amazons and so on, you know, hold huge sway. And there's going to have to be genuine questions as to what we do about that, you know, whether that's the world we want to live in or whether we wanted to change that. But yeah, fascinating.
So that's the end of the news section, and we've now covered our nefarious use of AI for the week, for those of you who were hotly anticipating that. Now let's move on to our main topic this week, and that's South by Southwest. So, John, impress us with your findings from America.
Okay, so I suppose just to start with, I'll give the quick synopsis of what South by Southwest is. And I suppose I'm doing that not just to give a rundown for people who are completely unaware of it, but a lot of people will know of it, but they'll know of it in terms of the music festival. So South by Southwest has been going for about 30 years. It's an amazingly successful conference and festival, but it covers a really broad range of stuff. I mean, it covers interactive health technology, music, film, gaming, and I suppose, you know, critically from my perspective in terms of innovation and AI, it's a real showcase for what's happening in the world of artificial intelligence, machine learning, also things like virtual reality, augmented reality, and broader innovation. So it feels like robotics. So it's just incredibly, incredibly broad. And in terms of the scale of it, so I read up some of the stats from last year's one that I was at, and afterwards they produced a sort of report on it, on the, you know, social impact and so on. And so about 420,000 people were directly involved last year. And obviously that includes a number of people who weren't delegates, but huge scale of the thing. 2,000 different conference sessions, more than 1,000 events, meetups and parties that were sort of unofficial, you know, not directly related to the event happening because it was on. More than 100 film premieres. The scale of it is just enormous.
Yeah, it sounds like a phenomenal conference. I think some of the conferences I go to are big with, you know, 40,000 delegates. But this sounds like a scale that's just out of this world.
It just takes over the whole,
like lifting
of Austin,
a whole
Texas, yeah,
city and just dumping it somewhere. And it sounds like a really rich melting pot of fascination.
Yeah, and they, I think they've obviously deliberately had it in Austin because of its kind of cultural roots, and that really does get reflected not only in the people that arrive, but in just the way that the event itself has evolved. It's got a really interesting kind of vibe to it, and the character and the nature of the place has a real profound impact on it. So yeah, fascinating to go to. So just to talk then a little bit about some of the highlights. So if I start with things that aren't the conference sessions, because I think it's worth talking around it a little bit before we dive into a few of the sessions. There's obviously a huge amount going on, and as well as being able to, you know, book and go into the conferences and the panel sessions and so on, there's just a huge amount that you can just wander into. There's different houses that the sort of tech giants have. So, you know, Google, Panasonic, Apple, Amazon, Microsoft, they all have sort of these houses that they take over that you go around and explore what they're doing and the tech that they're evolving and so on, which is great. And they have these immense exhibition halls. Now, the exhibition halls are just incredible. I mean, they're essentially laid out by country. So it's kind of a bit like having the Eurovision Song Contest of awful technology in a lot of places.
Sounds horrendous.
It is this bizarre mix where you'll have, you know, Austria presenting all of it, the cool technology that their companies have developed in the last year. So much like Eurovision, you get a whole bunch of repetitive things that are pretty much iterations of the same idea. And then just occasionally you come across that equivalent of a bearded transgender diva, and somehow it all just comes together and works. It is truly mental.
Are we suggesting that you are the Terry Wogan of South by Southwest?
Well, yeah, although it's not Terry Wogan anymore, is it? But yeah, it's anyway, can't even remember his name. So that is fascinating, just going around that and getting the curated experience of bizarre technology being thrown at you. So just to talk about some specifics. So Japan always has a really impressive, it's probably the biggest section, because as you'd imagine, they're just so into the evolution of technology and robotics and AI and so on. And, you know, to pick a couple of examples at random from that mix, there was a guy wandering around with a backpack on, which had this sort of extension above his head, which then had drone motors on it. And the whole purpose of this backpack was simply that you jumped into the air and it slightly slowed your descent down. It wasn't making you fly, it wasn't anything cool like that, it just slightly slowed your descent so you could get a fractional perception of weightlessness. And you're thinking, what on earth is the point of
this? So you've almost got an extra, maybe an extra couple of seconds when falling from a great height before you hit the ground. Well, I did see a photo of that on your Twitter feed. And for those of you who follow the podcast, go and check out John's Twitter feed. There's some really interesting photos from South by Southwest, including this one. I mean, I had no idea what the contraption was until John mentioned it. I know John had really high expectations for it until he found out what it actually was.
It was so disappointing. And then another one I came across. So there was an artificial intelligence cartoon generator. So the idea of this is you type in a little phrase that, you know, you would expect to be in a cartoon bubble, and then it will generate the cartoon that accompanies that text bubble. So the idea sounds really promising, but the execution was just terrible. It didn't seem to associate in any way with what I was trying to talk about. So that was slightly disappointing too. There was a home assistant called Aurora. So I mean, this is like from a fairly major player, but this little avatar character in the home assistant, so you could sort of see it and it could, like, you know, act and sort of wave and just have a little bit more of an emotional kind of engagement. And the idea and the principle of that, again, is quite a good one, but it was just wasn't very well executed.
Yeah, I think the question is, do we need another home assistant?
Indeed,
it sounds like Aurora may be joining Cortana in the graveyard of home assistants.
Of home assistants ending with the letter A.
Yes.
Although maybe not Alexa. And then to have another thing ending with the letter A, which was a really interesting one. So Seiya, I probably have pronounced that incredibly wrong, given it is Japanese. But this was an interesting one. It wasn't a commercial product in any way. It was simply a full-size kind of black screen that you walked up to. And when you went up to it, there was it was obviously rendered, so it was obviously an avatar, if you like, but a Japanese girl, so probably I guess 12, 13 years old, very sort of blank looking, you know, just staring back at you from the screen. So it was an odd kind of experience anyway. And then the idea is, as you walk up to her, it's detecting your facial features and detecting the emotional state that you have, and then she is then responding to that. So it's a, I mean, in one sense, you know, slightly disturbing, slightly odd, you know, Japanese schoolgirl. So it's got a whole kind of dynamic that you perhaps don't want to think about. But what was incredibly fascinating was the connection that it, at an emotional level, that it made with you. Because as soon as you sort of smiled a little bit, you just got the catch from her of her kind of responding to your smile and smiling back, which actually then genuinely makes you smile, and you think, oh, that's pleasant. You're getting a reaction back. And it was just fascinating to see how that connection kind of is made over something that you clearly know is utterly artificial and is not in any way sort of intelligent, in quotes, but is using this machine learning to look at the face and then adjust based on your emotion.
Yeah, and you know, when you think about it, it makes sense. You know, certainly our experience of people using, you know, more traditional AI technologies like chatbots, people know they are powered by a computer. They know there is not a real person at the other end, but, you know, 9 times out of 10 or more, people are really polite or really engage with these things as if there is a human at the other end. And I think this sort of thing, even though it wasn't a commercial product in any way at this time, you can almost imagine this becoming a, you know, a concierge in a hotel.
Yes.
And
yeah,
adapting itself if there's, you know, an angry customer who wants to make a complaint, or maybe, you know, being all smiley and happy when you turn up and you want to check in. Or maybe your flight was delayed and you get in and you just want to get to your room and go to bed, and it can adapt depending on your mood. I think that's really interesting.
Yeah, it's absolutely fascinating. I was quite impressed by that. Although, as you know, as I said, there's a little bit of an odd sort of, you know, Black Mirror kind of esque. I mean, literally, it was a Black Mirror, but also had the Netflix equivalent. Yeah, you know, the strange dystopian kind of future that you can imagine.
Yeah.
Along those lines, and it really did reflect the idea of that sort of uncanny valley that we're entering into, where things become almost human. They're close enough that you start to kind of be a little bit weirded out by them. And in fact, reflecting on that, one of the other things which I didn't go to, but one of the people that I was out there with did go to, was the Westworld experience. So I don't know if you have seen any of the Westworld series. So for those of you who may not be familiar with it, it's a HBO, I think it's HBO series, which is basically set in a mythical Wild West. But it's a Wild West that's populated by robots who don't know that they're robots. And therefore, the idea is it's effectively a theme park that you can go to and you can do whatever you want when you are there, because you are safe. They can't hurt you, but you can, of course, hurt or do whatever you want to them. So that has obviously raised a huge, you know, a response, if you like, from people thinking, you know, is this, how ethical is this? What's our response to this? Do we have any responsibility over things that clearly, you know, are not human, don't have the same feelings and emotions that we do, even if they're programmed to feel like they do? And so that series has been running for a while. It's based on a 1970s, I think, film with Yul Brynner. Brilliant film. But in the new series, in the lead up to that season kind of opening, they had this Westworld experience at South by Southwest, so you could actually go out into a place just outside of Austin. You were bussed out there, and then you could act as if you were a cowboy in this sort of in this town, where the actors in the town were therefore pretending to be robots pretending to be humans. So a fascinating kind of dynamic, and I think they were also reflecting that again, it's just changing this. It's challenging, I suppose, you know, what it is to be human and what it is to deal with things that you know are not human but are very close to being human.
Wow, fascinating.
Yeah, it absolutely was. And then on a sort of similar kind of line, but more of a kind of classic virtual reality slant, the Ready Player One film, which is obviously coming out, I think it's coming out this month.
Yeah, it's pretty soon.
The latest of the Steven Spielberg films. It's a massive mashup of 80s culture. But they had a huge VR experience, which was really impressive there. Just looking at, you know, how you can use that technology, because VR plays a huge role within the film Ready Player One. And so it was trying to sort of explore some of, you know, what it means to be able to see some of those experiences through VR. So yeah, fascinating.
So what about, give us a bit of an overview of some of the sessions that you went to. What were your favourites?
Okay, so I mean, the sessions there are you know, thousands of sessions that you can go to. So you know, even if I'd gone to all of the ones that I'd wanted to, which of course I got to about 10% of, I'd still only be able to talk about a few of them here. So I've just picked out three that I thought I'd spend a couple of minutes on because they just were really interesting for a variety of reasons. So the first of them was called Death and Legacy in the Digital Age. So this was a really fascinating talk. So a lady called Rebecca Blum, who's from Frog Design, she took on quite a hard topic. You know, what happens in a world where all our digital data stays on after we die, where Facebook is increasingly becoming a kind of a graveyard, where you know more and more people on there have passed away. How do we deal with that? How do we change our relationship with death in this new world, and how does technology impact that? So she wove together this amazing talk on the changing relationship that digital technologies have and continue to have on, you know, things like the concept of death, on the practice and the culture around death, and so on. And it was it was fascinating. So one of the examples that she gave, which was really compelling, there was a guy called Roman Mazurenko, and so he had a friend, Eugenia, and they were both quite heavily involved, I think, in machine learning and AI and doing some stuff with chatbots. And so when Roman died, quite suddenly, Eugenia actually put together all of the text messages that she'd received, all of the emails that he'd sent her, all of the letters that he'd sort of written to her, and tried to sort of collate these things together, because she kind of found that she just missed having conversations with him. So she put all these together and then trained a machine learning algorithm on it and turned it into a bot. I mean, it's a live bot that you can go and have a conversation with, which in itself is very odd. But it really does start to blur the lines between, you know, grief and just perpetually continuing that relationship. There's no cutoff point, if you like. Because one of the things that she was, that Rebecca was really commenting on was, in our normal relationship with death, there's a very clear distinction. You know, you go to a cemetery and it's got big gates for a reason, because you are entering, you are traveling, if you like, from one world to the next. And so there's a whole ritual around that. There's ceremonies, there's timing that goes along with it. And you start to think, well, this matters, this divide. But if you look at a Facebook page and you look at a Facebook memorial page, they're pretty much the same thing, apart from not being able to message the person. Yeah. There's not a lot of difference. And obviously the same with this chatbot. You know, there's no cutoff point. You can just have a conversation with someone who's died. And so she was talking about some of the other things which are starting to emerge, like augmented reality. And it starts to pose really interesting questions, like, you know, it's probably quite an interesting and probably quite comforting in some ways thing if you could have augmented reality, so that when you went to your grandparents' graveyard, they could have left you a message that you see in augmented reality whenever you go there. So, or maybe on an anniversary or something, you go there and you see a message that they've left for you. But probably not quite as cool as if when you're on your way into Tesco's, suddenly your granny appears, because it's starting to blur those lines. So
I think the example that you pulled out of the chatbot that was created from all of the text messages, that was actually featured on Radio 4 a few weeks ago. Mm. And I was listening to the experience of how people are actually using that. The people who knew him are talking to that bot every day, and, you know, almost carrying on those conversations and are using it to work through that grief. But even more interestingly, there's people all over the world talking to this chatbot and simply just sharing things they wouldn't share with anybody else, with this personality. And it really does start to explore that, the connection between humans, and how much do you need to be actually sharing your feelings with another human, or when you can actually share your feelings with a bot that's designed to be a human and is based on lots of existing human interactions, and therefore it feels very human anyway. I mean, it unlocks a whole heap of experiences.
It absolutely does. I mean, interesting that you talk about that, sort of almost like the mental well-being side of things. So the head of the Beamer AI think tank. So Pete Trainer is heavily involved in this area. And one of the things that he was talking to me about and just unpacking and has done in a number of talks is the way in which our relationship with a machine obviously is subtly different from our relationship when we're talking to a human, and can be really, really compelling and useful in allowing people to open up in ways that they might not ever. And so certainly things like male suicide prevention, knowing that you're not talking to a human at the end of this line, if you like, but you're actually just able to out what you're feeling, which still has all the benefits of getting stuff off your chest, can actually be, yeah, very powerful.
Yeah, absolutely.
So the second one of the talks that I wanted to give a shout out to was actually, I've got to do it really, it's from a friend of mine. So this is Rob Belgrave and Jim Bowes. So they had, they've got a podcast of their own. It's the Alexa Stop podcast. And they had a session at South by Southwest called The Best Is Yet to Come, Digital Renaissance. So that was genuinely one of my highlights. They were really taking an unfailingly positive view of AI and technology and development. Because I think there's a tendency, I guess, for some people to get quite pessimistic and doom-mongering about not just AI, but a lot of our dystopian future sort of predictions. And they really wanted to just counter that rhetoric and start looking at the Renaissance that happened in the 14th and 15th century as a model for saying, actually, what could happen if we get into this world of abundance that technology has the potential to offer? So you look at what happened in that time, and obviously that was after the Black Death. So you got a huge reduction in population, which led to a massive amount of abundance. And therefore it was saying, look at everything that came out of that period of history in terms of technology and art and science and so on. And incredible leap forward, if you like, for mankind. So they were looking at some of the developments that are happening in the world of energy, transportation, communication, ethics, robotics, manufacturing, artificial intelligence, blockchain, all those kind of areas, and saying, do you know what? There is such a potential in these areas. And obviously, from our perspective, AI is quite a big part of that. Potential for this to really be entering into a new renaissance, which is, really fascinating.
Yeah, absolutely. And the third session that you've got and you've picked out, I'm really interested to hear about. How did you get up to book your place for this session?
So I must admit, I did get out of bed at about 5:30 in the morning to go and queue so that I could be part of the Elon Musk Q&A session, which was, I suppose, everything I had kind of hoped it would be. I mean, some people can get very dismissive about Elon. I know that, but he is an incredibly influential, he's a global figure. You can't really argue with it. He really does sit up there because of the impact he's having on, not just science, technology, because of some of the businesses, but he's inspiring a whole generation with some of the stuff that he's doing in the SpaceX area. So yeah, I was really keen to go and be part of that. I mean, there's not a lot you can say about that that hasn't already been said. I mean, he was really playing his greatest hits. I mean, we were in the Austin, the big auditorium where you'll have all of the country and Western stars performing, and he was totally playing his greatest hits to a very willing and supportive audience. So it was SpaceX. They showed a load of behind the scenes footage when they were in the control centers of that, and it was beautiful just watching Elon's face on stage as they replayed that clip of the two boosters landing simultaneously. He was just like a kid, who just seen this incredible sight. So yeah, that was brilliant. Also talked a lot about Tesla. Interestingly, a little bit about the machine brain interface, which was, because obviously he's working on that, I suppose, in response to his take on AI.
you know, I'm really quite interested to sort of see what he said there, because he's got quite an interesting perspective on AI, hasn't he? I mean, as we've seen from, you know, spats on Twitter with Mark Zuckerberg and other people, he does have a different perspective than some people, doesn't he?
Yeah, I mean, so he famously not just sceptical, but deeply worried about AI and its potential to be something which, you know, effectively ends our species. I don't think he's saying that in the way that some people do, as just a bit of a, you know, publicity and wanting to sort of scaremonger. I think he is the sort of person who deeply thinks about these things and has come to the conclusion that it has the potential to be an existential threat.
Interestingly enough, you know, and we haven't mentioned this, but obviously in the last month we lost Professor Stephen Hawking, and he had publicly said some, you know, came out with some, you know, fairly similar sentiments about the dangers and the risks of AI moving forward. And I think a lot of us, you know, myself included, a lot of the time we'll think, yeah, you know, scaremongering, there's a lot of, you know, people pointing to Skynet in Terminator, but these people are not stupid people. No. They are genuinely, you know, thinking these through at a very, very deep level. So it's certainly something that we shouldn't just dismiss.
Yeah, and of course, some people's reaction to that is then to say, oh, well, but he's building self-driving cars, so clearly he's not, you know, living up to his own standards. And I think we've got to, again, be careful that we're really clear about what we're talking about here, because when we talk, a lot of the time when we're talking about AI, we're talking about very clearly about narrow AI. We're talking about things which are in a limited domain to fulfill a specific purpose. We're not talking about the same thing that Elon Musk is talking about in this context, which is general or strong AI, yep. You know, heading towards that territory where something is, you know, almost on every front equal or superior to a human being. We're talking about it in a much more limited sense. So he has deep concerns over research that's going into that kind of very generalized, open, you know, growth area of general AI.
Yeah, so thanks very much, John. That was a really interesting rundown of your experience at South by Southwest, or, you know, 1% of South by Southwest.
It obviously was such a small summary, but yeah, time limits.
What are you up to over the next few weeks between now and the next episode?
So I'm just trying to think. Yeah, last week I was at a Technova Market Force event on AI and financial services. So there's some stuff which will be happening as a result of that, which is great because we love getting involved with supporting financial services businesses in understanding what's possible with AI. I've also got a meeting with the British Interactive Media Association's AI think tank. I managed to miss the last one because I was out at South by Southwest. So it'll be good to really catch up on that, find out what's happening, what people are up to. I'm also speaking at a university to some students there about, it's an interesting one, it's about how AI is being used to sort of drive fake news and also could be instrumental in helping to prevent it. So that'll be a fascinating one. And then a little bit later, so I think it's start of next month, speaking at a utility conference on how AI can support sort of electricity, gas, water companies.
Oh, great. And I know I'm going to be at Utility Week with you and hopefully sharing some of our AI knowledge and experience with the attendees there. I'm also going to be out speaking at Intelligent Cloud Conference in May out in Copenhagen. Very much looking forward to that and talking about how you can go about building intelligent chatbots now. I'm also heading back out to Seattle to spend some time with the engineering teams out at Microsoft and see what latest innovations they've got coming in the AI and bot space. So that's going to be fascinating.
And hopefully they'll allow you to talk about at least some
maybe
of them.
We'll see.
We'll see. Well, I suppose in light of the loss of Stephen Hawking, then maybe we should end with one of his quotes. So he said, "The greatest enemy of knowledge is not ignorance; it is the illusion of knowledge." And I think we're sometimes guilty in a happy way of contributing a little bit to that illusion of knowledge of people.
Yes. Yeah. So so that's it for this episode. Keep an eye out for the next one. And as always, if you've got any comments or feedback, please do reach out to us via Twitter or one of our other many channels. And we'll see you next time.
You've been listening to This Is AI, a podcast brought to you by Mando with Gary Pretty and Jonathan Seal. You can follow us on Twitter. Just search for This Is AI. And please remember to share and rate the show. Join us next time. And thanks for listening.